Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box podcast on The Times. I'm Matt Chorley with this autumn statement special. I'm joined by Lucy Fisher, senior political correspondent for The Times, Labour MP Rachel Reeves and Ryan Shorthouse from the Bright Blue think tank. Britain is going to spend an extra £122 billion by 2020, Philip Hammond confirmed. About 60-odd billion of that directly linked to the decision to leave the EU. Philip Hammond said that vote in June will change the course of Britain's history, and it seems to have changed the course of Britain's finances as well. Let's start with you, Lucy. What did you make of Philip Hammond's statement overall? What was the overall impression that you got?
Just one of gloom, really. As you say, this remarkable figure of £122 billion by 2021, that the government finances will be worse than we thought previously. And there was a sort of gasp that went out across the chamber when he said that debt would peak at 90% of GDP in 2017. It was a gasp almost as loud as when the House learnt that Rotherham has a stately home.
So that was a bizarre little... We were promised he wasn't going to do any little policies and little announcements like that, but he announced some extra money for this stately home in Rotherham. Slightly out of nowhere. Rachel, what was your take on it? Because it is amazing that it wasn't that long ago. George Osborne was still, as we know, back in March when he was still Chancellor. He was still clinging to the idea of a surplus by 2020. I mean, that's just gone flying out of the window. There's now no... I think he said as early as possible or something is now the official line. There's no prospect of a surplus anytime soon.
Yes, so I think the fiscal rules that the government have now adopted are similar to those that Ed Miliband and Ed Balls proposed back in 2010. So we are now going to have a surplus as soon as possible in the next parliament, which probably means by about 2025. So huge change, and it means that not closing the deficit in one parliament as Osborne first set out, or in two parliaments as Osborne then set out. So now it's going to look like three parliaments to get rid of the budget deficit. And even I think the forecasts today are possibly quite optimistic. The economy will still be growing in every year of this parliament, admittedly not nearly as fast as was previously expected, but growth at the lowest I think is 1.4% next year, but then above 2% for the rest of the forecast horizon. So many people are saying that there is a risk that the economy has overheated, that the uncertainty around Brexit, the sharp falls in sterling and the increases in inflation might lead to a recession further down the line. So there's still a possibility that these forecasts, both for growth and for the public finances, are too optimistic.
The OBR's track record on this hasn't been great. I mean, one of the striking things I thought was that, particularly on the borrowing figures, they've revised them for March because they think things are going to be worse. But then there's extra borrowing on top of that as a result of the measures that Philip Hammond has taken, which shows that the idea of austerity has sort of gone out of the window. He is now borrowing more money than George Osborne planned to, out of choice as well as out of the necessity of what's happening to the economy.
Yes, well, so I think that Philip Hammond and the government would argue that in this environment of uncertainty, it makes sense to have a slower process of closing the budget deficit, and I think that's fair enough. And as well as the automatic stabilisers, so the natural increases in spending and reductions in tax revenue when the economy turns a bit more sour, the government are also ploughing additional resources into the economy. And there is some of that today, definitely some loosening in policy, but. You know, on things like universal credit, I'm not sure that the government have gone far enough. I mean, there was a lot of talk about them reversing the changes to universal credit, but actually what we saw was instead of a taper rate of 65%, it's now going to be 63%. So if you're on universal credit, for every pound you earn extra, you get to keep 37 pence of it now rather than 35.
It's not a huge amount, that, is it?
No, and it means that you've got a marginal tax rate for the lowest paid, which is higher than for any other group, and three times higher than the marginal tax rate for someone who pays a basic rate of income tax.
And that's where it flies in the face of the idea of trying to get people to take on more hours, because every hour they take on, they earn more money, but they lose loads of the.
Yeah, so for every pound they earn, they're going to be losing 63 pence of it. And that's not a great incentive to get extra hours and get a pay rise. So I think that's a real missed opportunity, because we do need to encourage those on low incomes to work more hours to boost their incomes. It's good for them and their families, but it's good for the wider economy as well. And so I think that was a missed opportunity today to really help those families who Theresa May spoke about in her conference speech and on the steps of Downing Street. That's just about managing families. And I think they won't be managing really very much better after the Chancellor's autumn statement today.
Ryan, what did you make overall, but also the way that the OBR has tried to put a figure on the cost of Brexit? I mean, it's £58.6 billion, which they link in the many, many tables they publish alongside the autumn statement. They link that directly to the decision that was taken by voters in June and the process of trying to leave.
Yeah, I'll come on to that. I mean, just, you know, I'm not the politician here representing a political party, but, you know, the taper rate of 63% is lower than what it was under the last Labour government. And many people had taper rates which were substantially higher than that. I agree.
That's not entirely true, Ryan. It is true for a very small number of people there was a higher taper rate, but the average taper rates for universal credit are much higher. I mean, the cuts to universal credit, the most recent cuts, are worth something like £3.8 billion compared to where it was previously. So obviously money is being taken out of the pockets of low-income earners. You're right that there were some anomalies in the old tax credit system, which is why myself and the Labour Party support the move to universal credit, but you know, you shouldn't really argue that this system is less generous than what replaced it.
Let's not get too bogged down in what happened six years ago. We've been through several Labour shadow chances in that time. So let's concentrate on what was in it today and looking forward.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I agree with Rachel that it would have been better if they targeted the work allowances rather than the taper rate. That would have been a more progressive move. But I think really the overall impression I've got is, you know, Hammond has offered compromise, basically. The fiscal reality and the fiscal hawks on one side of the argument. On the other side is we must do more to support those people who are just about managing, who, you know, are fed up with the so-called liberal elite and have had a kind of cry of pain from the Brexit vote. And he tried to reconcile between those two arguments. And so you've got very kind of compromised positions on universal credit, for example. And even, for example, the overall tone, you know, Brexiteers have said, don't indulge in Project Fear, Philip Hammond. The threat was made. So he couldn't be too pessimistic, but nor could he be too optimistic, because, as Rachel said, the borrowing figures are not good, nor are the growth figures, which have been revised down by just upward of 2% because of Brexit into 2021. Another point to make is, you know, a lot of people are saying, what's so different about the May government to the Cameron government? Actually, there's been a lot of consistency there. For example, the personal tax allowance, the rise in the upper rate of tax, the 40p band up to 50 grand. There's been a lot of consistency.
And that's the sort of thing that, if you really wanted to show you on the side of the just managing, giving a tax break to people earning between £45,000 and £50,000 may not be the place that you would start for that. This is the moment he could have chosen to push that off a bit or water it down or say it's only when we've helped people lower down. And he hasn't chosen to do that. They're still carrying on with those tax cuts.
Correct. I mean, you know, I recognise the fiscal reality, but, you know, there are choices within that. And instead of, you know, up raising the personal tax allowance or raising the top rate of tax, he could have done more in the universal credit. He could have raised, for example, the payment in which the threshold for the payment of national insurance by employees. They would have been more targeted progressive moves. But I think my overall point is that there's a lot of consistency here, despite the rhetoric. And actually, really, we're going into very turbulent times for the economy. If you look closely, the economic indicators are not great. And I actually think he could have been more radical, for example, on corporation tax, and he could have been more radical in supporting the Just About Managing because of the turbulent times ahead.
So what do we think overall of him as the Chancellor, first big event at the dispatch box? He made quite a good joke early on about how comparing himself to George Osborne and saying he would be more adept at putting rabbits out of hats than Boris Johnson was at retrieving balls from the back of the scrum. But actually, there weren't many rabbits to get particularly excited about. What did you make of the overall tone and the way he delivered it, Lucy?
Well, I think he's been quite cautious, and I think he's been quite canny in the sort of flexibility he's allowed himself. The new fiscal framework he unveiled seems to have been welcomed by economists and cities, for saying it's very reasonable within the revised down growth forecast. I think of the big rhetoric about helping the jams, the Just About Managing classes, has possibly been a bit talked up from, he did say at the beginning, well, I'm not going to do rabbits like George did, but just as, Boris didn't take the ball, whatever. I think I'm very much, as someone who's renting in London, I'm glad to see letting fees cancelled, wiped out, abolished. I think that's a good move, obviously.
Although it's interesting that Gavin Barwell, the housing minister, didn't think to delete the tweet that he wrote about 8 weeks ago saying this was a terrible idea and would just push up rents.
Yes, that's a very good point. And I mean, people are still kind of asking, why he didn't do anything on stamp duty, at least for first-time buyers, helping people to get onto the ladder. So I sort of think that, there's been a bit here and there, but not that much for the Just About Managing people. They went on so much about beforehand.
It is interesting. One of the things that struck me was a lot of the stuff that they sort of bundled together in the pre-brief. Actually, if they drizzled that out over a few weeks, it might have built up a bit of a sense of the government doing stuff other than Brexit. And so they sort of bundled it all together. It became bullet points in stories today. I suspect by the end of the week, we'll have forgotten about most of it.
I get the impression that Philip Hammond feels he hasn't got much room for manoeuvre because of the state of the public finances, because of the uncertainty in the economy. And ultimately, the government are going to be judged by people's living standards, how people are feeling, how optimistic they are feeling, and the gimmicks that Lucy spoke about in the end don't deliver.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Those things. So, he could have done things like the air passenger duty and all the rest of it, but in the end they are just gimmicks and they're not ultimately going to make people feel better off. So in some ways I think he got the tone about right today, but I think that what you go away with is a sense of the precariousness of the economic situation at the moment, that the government have a very large budget deficit, that the economy is not going to be growing even at the rates we've seen over the last few years. And the rates we've seen over the last few years have not exactly delivered big rises in living standards, especially for those at the bottom and the middle end of the income spectrum. Where I think the government could have done more, there are two areas really. I think that, as Ryan said, they could have done more to help those Just About Managing rather than those higher up in the income spectrum. And of course, the increase in the level at which you start paying the top rate of tax up to £50,000 doesn't just help people earning between 45 and 50,000, it helps people earning anything over that amount. And so 85% of the income tax changes announced today benefit the top half of the income distribution. And yet most people think it's those at the bottom half of the income distribution who need a bit of extra help at the moment. So I think that's a real missed opportunity. More should have been done on universal credit and less to help those people at the top. The other area where I think it could come back to bite the government is on the National Health Service and social care. And it was quite interesting in the questions to the Chancellor following the autumn statement, including from the chair of the Health Select Committee, the Conservative MP, Sarah Wollaston, many questions about social care budgets and the pressure that's putting on the National Health Service. And, you know, remember, a lot of people voted to leave the European Union because there was going to be this extra money. £350 million a week, I believe. To fund the National Health Service. And of course, there's no sign of that money coming. We know that NHS trusts are under a huge amount of pressure. Many of them are in deficits. We know that local authorities are also under a huge amount of pressure in terms of funding social care, which puts more pressure on the National Health Service. And there was nothing in the autumn statement today about either National Health Service or social care. And as we go into the winter months, I think that that is perhaps something that might come back to bite the government when those winter crises inevitably come.
Dare I say it, Rachel, that was a far more fluent critique of the autumn statement than the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonald, managed, not least because he started off with this morning, despite it being well past lunchtime, so he doesn't even seem to know what the time of the day is. How did you think John did?
Well, John McDonald, as we know, likes to talk about his breakfast, doesn't he? So maybe he was still thinking about that. I think at times we wondered whether Ed Balls might descend from the roof of the House of Commons playing a piano, ready to deliver a Labour response, but it was not to be. Look, you know, it is a really difficult job. I supported Ed Balls and many budgets and autumn statements. It's a really difficult job to respond either to the budget or to the autumn statement because you don't have the numbers in front of you. You don't know what the government are going to announce. And I think at one point, John McDonnell said he welcomed the extra money for the social care budget, but it wasn't enough. Now, it wasn't enough because there wasn't any, but John McDonnell had generously anticipated that Philip Hammond would at least announce some money. He assumed there would be at least something for social care. So I think it's a difficult job. And with budgets and autumn statements, what I've always found is that they don't unravel when the Shadow Chancellor or the leader of the opposition makes their initial responses. They unravel in the days and the weeks after when people have a chance to unpick the numbers. So I think that that is what will happen with this budget, but this autumn statement, but most of all because of what I've said, that I think that the public finances and the economy is in a pretty precarious situation at the moment, primarily because of Brexit, and that's certainly the Office for Budget Responsibility's perspective, but also just, you know, some of the challenges that we face haven't gone away, and as a result the economy is weaker than really it should be at this stage.
Ryan or Lucy, I mean, I think Rachel's obviously being very polite about her Shadow Chancellor. The truth is that the government basically feels it can do what it likes, on particularly on the economy. Their lead on economic competence in the polls is sort of 40-odd% or something. They feel absolutely no pressure from the opposition. You know, as far as voters are concerned, they're the only game in town. These are gloomy figures. They'll anticipate they will have forgotten all about them by the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it was interesting, in a way you'd expect this perhaps, but Philip Hammond sort of referenced David Burrows, backbench Tory MP, when he unveiled the cut to the taper rate in universal credit, because that's something that a Tory backbencher has been lobbying for. So I think, you know, it shows you the power that Tory backbenchers do have, given that the government has a very slim working majority of 14. But no, I don't think it pays any attention to the opposition benches at all.
Ryan?
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, for example, you know, there are some interesting things in the autumn statement. One was the funding for grammar schools, the new funding for grammar schools. And the evidence against grammar schools is quite compelling. And with a stronger opposition, I think it would have been harder for the government to press ahead with that. They feel that they've probably got more mileage, but let's see what happens in the course of that. Another interesting thing which came up was that Hammond mentioned the triple lock on state pensions. But then he hinted, actually, that this would come under review for the next parliament. And a lot of people who've been working on the welfare space have said, actually, there's been quite a disproportionate focus on working age benefits, and pensioners have not been as impacted as much by the cuts. So I think that's a good move. But again, you know, I think these things could have come forward, so you could have given more to people on universal credit.
Because post-Brexit, when Philip Hammond became Chancellor, he talked about an economic reset. Well, you only get to reset, really, at the beginning. Otherwise, you're resetting your own... This was his big moment for radical change, and he doesn't really seem to have gripped that.
I think that's right, yeah. And, you know, is he captive or is he just too conservative? I'm not sure, but I think the time that we're in post-Brexit, the dark economic kind of clouds which are gathering, you know, people are frustrated that their living standards are not rising. This was a chance to reset economic policy, but I think it was too continuity.
Does anybody think there's anything in it that George Osborne wouldn't have done if he'd stayed on as post-Brexit Chancellor? It didn't feel to me like there was a great deal. Rachel?
I think, to be fair to George Osborne, he did believe in the Northern powerhouse and the devolution policy. And I don't think we got very much of that today.
Apart from a stately home in Rotherham.
Which is very, very welcomed by the people of Rotherham. In my constituency, we had floods, awful floods last December. And we're still really waiting for a commitment for funding of the flood defences. And things like that, I think, were much more on the radar of George Osborne than they appeared to be with Philip Hammond. That infrastructure investment that we need, particularly in the north of England, there were lots of complaints from Labour colleagues about no mention of Transpennine Express, which is in desperate need of additional funding, whilst there was mention of roads and railways in the south of England. So I think that George Osborne did have a bit more of a focus on that devolution and that economic potential outside of London and the south east. Philip Hammond said that, you know, that the growth has been fastest in the northeast and job creation fastest in a different part of the country, as if everything was all well and good in terms of the regional balance of the economy. And frankly, it's not. And it would have been nice to hear a bit more from the Chancellor about that.
And actually, what if you look over a longer period of time, all that means is that the recovery, such as it is since the recession, has come to those places later. So London was steaming ahead of those regions earlier on. And now, you know, those other regions which have picked up. What about you, Lucy? Is there anything that you thought that George Osborne wouldn't have done?
Well, just picking up on what Rachel said, I think certainly the only 23 billion for this innovation infrastructure fund seems quite a low figure, given how that was sort of talked up, the sort of focus now on productivity and improving that in the UK. And when you do compare that to Labour, I think that is one area perhaps the opposition benches could knob with the government, is, you know, John McDonnell is promising a 350 billion infrastructure national bank fund. So I think, you know, the government's figure is just so much lower.
There was 1.3 billion for traffic pinch points, which sounds a bit like that's a few roundabouts and extra pull-in areas for when it gets busy, which doesn't strike me as being all that major. Before we finish, let's just quickly touch on the fact that he announced that this is going to be the last ever autumn statement, before then telling us it's going to be replaced by a spring statement instead. So the budget will be in the autumn. There'll then be a spring statement. But to get to that point, we're going to have two budgets next year. So instead, far from having fewer fiscal events, which is what he appeared to be promising, we're going to have two budgets next year. What did you make of that, Rachel? Good idea, bad idea, pointless idea?
Well, I think getting rid of the autumn statement isn't necessarily a bad idea, but that's not what he ended up doing. That's where he started, but ended up, as you said, Matt, with two budgets next year. And then the year after that, one budget, a spring statement, and in the spring statement, if needed, having a few fiscal measures, if that's what's required at the time. So apart from changing the time of year of the budget and changing the time of the year of the autumn statement, there wasn't really much change.
I think it's quite a good thing, actually, in the sense that actually it prepares more for the next tax year and gives a kind of 6 months buy-in time for it, which, you know, allows more preparation, businesses, individuals to plan and prepare for that. So I think it's the right move.
It also, of course, allows them a bit more space with Article 50 being revoked by the end of March to let that play out a bit before, well, I suppose he's still got to do the first budget, but he can reset that pretty quickly afterwards instead of waiting a full 12 months.
I hadn't thought of that. For a moment, I'd forgotten about Article 50 and Brexit. but we'll soon return to that. Well, on that note, thank you, all of you, for joining us this afternoon. Do remember you can read far more about everything that was in the autumn statement at thetimes.co.uk and obviously in the Times newspaper. Do remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on your Android device so it arrives every time we do an extra one like this. And while you're there, why not leave another one of these really helpful reviews on iTunes? You can sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox email. But for now, from Lucy, Rachel, Ryan and me, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
so
how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.